You know, it's just that I always felt at home in nature. Unlike human societies, there's no malice in nature. There's difficulty in nature, and there's competition in nature and the necessities of nature, but there's no malice. You know, whatever violence we see is not intentional violence. It's violence because someone needs food, or, you know, an animal is protecting a den of young. I think that absence of malice was what attracted me to nature as much as anything.
Today on Tartan Talks, we're going back to nature. Specifically, nature poetry, like Robert Frost, Wendell Berry, and Mary Oliver. Our guest is Dr. Bob Haas from Edinburgh University's English and Philosophy Department. He's also one of the resident nature poet enthusiasts and experts who has written books about Robert Frost and has composed his own poetry collections. Today we talked about how important it is to get back to nature, to experience everything from the sun overhead to the river alongside our pathway to the sand and grass under our feet. We also talked about the poets that made the most impact on Dr. Bob Haas and where the field is going in the future. So thanks for joining us here today on Tartan Talks. We hope you enjoy our conversation about nature poetry, about Robert Frost, and about all things that make life beautiful. This is Tartan Talks, a podcast from Edinburgh University. I'm your host, Christopher LaFuria. Each month, we'll take a look at individuals who make Edinburgh an exciting, diverse, and profound place to discover your passions. All right, so welcome here today on Tartan Talks. We have Dr. Bob Haas from Edinburgh's English and Philosophy Department. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Happy to be here, thanks.
All right, I wanted to start off with something. It's words of one of my favorite nature poets, and you can probably guess who it is just by the intro, but it's one of those things that will lead right into our topic, and it's one of the moments that really stuck out to me as we transitioned from winter to spring. So The poem goes like this. In winter, all the singing is in the tops of the trees, where the wind bird with its white eyes shoves and pushes among the branches. Like any of us, he wants to go to sleep, but he's restless, he has an idea, and slowly it unfolds from under his beating wings as long as he stays awake. This is Mary Oliver. Right. This poem I like because we are transitioning from winter to spring, and it kind of opens our eyes to the written word as it ties to our visual senses. So a lot of the things we see can kind of transition into a poem like this. And the way I see it is Mary Oliver, just like us, kind of like we're all restless, we all are tired, but we know like the story's unfolding before us. Dr. Bob Haas, professor of English here at Edinburgh, a fan and expert on nature poetry, and also an expert on Robert Frost. So give us a little bit of your background, whether it's your own writing experience, whether your research. Talk to us about your areas of expertise.
Well, I just happen to be the child of two scientists. My father had a PhD in biochemistry. My mother had degrees in zoology. And as the child of a scientist, I had firsthand knowledge of how the world really worked. So when I asked my father why the grass was green, for example, he didn't give me an easy answer because God made it that way. He explained to me the process of photosynthesis and chlorophyll and the idea that a blade of grass would reflect a particular wavelength of light. And so, you know, being the child of scientists, I had immediate answers. Also being the child of scientists, I developed a very keen sense of our place in the natural world. Both of my parents were staunch environmentalists. My father loved to birdwatch and botanize around the woods in our house. And I grew up kind of on the outskirts of Hershey, Pennsylvania in the Sand Hills, where there were only about four houses in my immediate neighborhood, and there was a farm with lots of acreage in the backyard with both fields and woods. And these became the great playgrounds for my brother and me, and then later my sister when she came along. And so we grew up in the woods, looking at things, hearing birds, listening to the lessons of my mother and father. And those lessons proved to be absolutely invaluable to me. And they've stayed with me ever since. So in some way, you know, I really didn't have a choice. I just grew into, or was born into, a household where nature and love of the wild was part of the ethos of the family.
So at face value, it kind of almost seems like you have two parents that are heavily involved in science. At first glance, having two parents in science and then you being involved in the arts and English and writing, you could almost assume that it was kind of like you were kind of like deterred from being a scientist, either as an act of rebellion or as an act of, you know, wanting to find your own path. But it almost seems like this was a, not to use a pun or anything, but this almost seems like a natural result for you. Instead of using your career choice and your area of expertise as a rebellion, it almost like nurtured your interest in this area, whereas you didn't specifically go into the science or zoology or botany. You just took a different aspect of it and went into the artistic side of what you were learning from them. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes. You know, even though my parents were scientists, they were extremely well-educated and well-rounded people who also had a love of literature and the arts and music. And they never deterred any of us from pursuing what it was that we liked. Now, I don't know why I initially chose poetry. Sometimes, you know, there's a cliche whereby the art chooses you. But I do know that once you fall in love with poetry, you become addicted to it. And I learned to love poetry at a very young age because I was reading A Child's Garden of Verses by Robert Louis Stevenson and reading Dr. Seuss books. So there was something about the magic of words that attracted me to poetry. And so you combine that love with the family love of the natural world and the setting in which I grew up, it was almost inevitable that I would gravitate toward this discipline.
Yeah, and it's also interesting. There are several layers that I find fascinating with being a poet and studying nature poetry. So if you think about the arts in general, you have the illustrators that actually have pencils that can create their art. And you have painters that use paint and acrylic and watercolors to make art. Whereas poetry, you just have words that everybody else uses. Furthermore, with nature poetry, you have basic things that everybody sees. Like with Mary Oliver's instance, you have the wind bird. With Wendell Berry, you have the wood drake. You have all these things that you see every day and all these words that everybody uses. Talk about that aspect of poetry and why that resonated so much with you for a field.
Well, one of the beauties of both Mary Oliver's and Wendell Berry's work is they take us into the particular material world and they recreate it for us. And so when you read a poem by Wendell Berry, especially, for example, you see that there's not a lot of rhetorical flourish in the poetry. You see a lot of emphasis on nouns and verbs. He takes us into the world of things, and so does Mary Oliver. And so I think one of the beauties of both hiking in the woods and writing nature poetry is that you recognize you're in the middle of an aesthetic experience. I mean, when you think about the aesthetic experience and you define what aesthetic means, it means that you're fully alive and that your senses are fully awakened to the possibilities of the world around you, as opposed to a kind of anesthetic, benumbing world of things that are dead, you know? And so when I'm in the woods, walking or bird watching or walking with my puppy, you know, I marvel at the things that I see and I pay attention. And because I had a father who was a scientist, I learned how to pay attention very early in my life. And so I think in some ways I see the woods a little bit differently than other people do. But once you're in that habit, you never escape it. Every time I drive down the highway and see a bird, I identify that bird, I have to look. And so that sense of seeing, that sense of being in the moment without any of the distractions or other noise around us becomes that enlivening aesthetic experience that I particularly crave and that I think a lot of people crave.
Yeah, it's almost like you're activating like your meta senses, because not only are you experiencing things with your eyes and your ears and the smell, but you're thinking about those senses at a higher level. Like, how can you put to words what that smell is or what that sound is?
Yeah. And of course, there's a music to poetry that's intrinsic to the line of poetry itself. You know, Ezra Pound has a great definition of the word. He calls it an emotional intellectual complex in an instant of time. So as you were talking about the other media that artists use, you know, the poet uses words, and the beauty of using words as your medium is that not only do words refer to things, but also those things carry an emotional connotation with them. And we can also think about abstractions and words about feeling as well. So when we use language properly, we're always trying to tune ourselves to the possibility of being both intellectual and emotionally authentic simultaneously. That sense that you're talking about is inherent in the medium of language itself.
So do you remember your earliest time when you thought, when you were walking through the woods and you thought, man, I should commit this to paper as a poem, or I should really read what other people are saying about this? Can you remember a time when it was more than just a walk in the woods, it was something you wanted to capture through poetry?
Well, you know, I started writing when I was very young. I think one of the first poems I ever wrote was called "There Is a Land Under a Stream." And it was an imagined world of a place that may have been better than the place that I was living in at the moment. And, you know, it's just that I always felt at home in nature. Unlike human societies, there's no malice in nature. There's difficulty in nature, and there's competition in nature and the necessities of nature, but there's no malice. You know, whatever violence we see is not intentional violence. It's violence because someone needs food or because someone is protecting a den of young or something, you know, an animal is protecting a den of young. You know, I think that absence of malice was what attracted me to nature as much as anything. The way that we treat each other sometimes in our social world, I think sometimes can be mollified and mitigated if we spent more time in nature.
Took a walk through the woods or outside with our
pups. How does that sound? I'm trying to think of something, and these are questions where I'm going far back.
I always like to stretch your memory and to stretch your imagination here, because it's interesting, because, you know, poetry is different to everybody. I love nature poetry, but I also like, you know, urban poetry, some from the Harlem Renaissance and some from, you know, modern day poets. So there's so many different layers, and things can mean different things at different times too. So take us back to when you were either studying in college or early on in your career. Talk about some of the nature poets that drew you into that field. Some of the people like Wendell Berry and Robert Frost. And why did they originally capture your attention as people you wanted to dedicate your time to study?
Well, one of the reasons that I studied Robert Frost is because I recognized in his poetry the flora and fauna that I knew from growing up in the woods of Pennsylvania.
Interesting.
Even though he writes mostly about New Hampshire and Vermont and other New England landscapes, those landscapes were close enough to my own that I saw this incredible familiarity. And my family and I used to vacation up at Lake George every summer. And just across Lake Champlain, of course, is Middlebury College and the Breadloaf Writers Conference, where Robert Frost had his cabin where he spent the summers in the later years of his life. And I would always hike around those areas with my father, and there was a Robert Frost interpretive trail. And my father had the great occasion of seeing Robert Frost read at the University of Minnesota when my father was postdocing there.
Oh, wow.
So Frost came to me naturally. And then, you know, as I was studying poetry, I read poets like Elizabeth Bishop, who's a great nature poet, Theodore Retke, who's a great nature poet. Some of Robert Lowell's early work is fabulous. Richard Wilbur, Mary Oliver, of course. And, you know, that kind of mid-century class of poets from the 20th century really excited me. I couldn't get enough of them. And I just found a natural kinship with them because I recognized what they were writing about. And because I have a deep love of nature and living things, I recognize that they did as well.
Very interesting. And I've read a lot of Robert Frost. I think that's one of the poets that a lot of people in high school, when you learn poetry, everybody reads The Road Not Taken, a lot of his popular things. But you've done more with Robert Frost than just study. Talk a little bit about some of the projects you've worked on, some of the research, and some of the national attention you've gotten by working on the works of Robert Frost.
Well, the book that I wrote on Robert Frost was a book on Robert Frost and science called Going by Contraries, Robert Frost Conflict with Science. And essentially, the great theme of the book is that Robert Frost developed a career in some ways out of a conflict between science and religion. He grew up in a very religious household. His mother was something of a Swedenborgian mystic. And when he was a young man, he was introduced to Charles Darwin and the natural world by an older friend of his named Carl Burrell, who introduced him to the works of Darwin and Huxley. And of course, those works challenged religious belief. So there's a tender-hearted side to Robert Frost that wanted to kind of rescue the essence of religious belief, I think. But there was also the tough-minded realist Robert Frost that recognized that all of what was rational in the modern world was telling him that some kind of traditional religious belief was no longer tenable. So he struggled throughout his life to try and reconcile those two elements of his personality and being. And so that's essentially what the book is about. Frost loved science. He had dinner with Niels Bohr at Amherst College. He knew Darwin up and down. And as I was reading the poems, because I had some experience in science myself and had minored in biology, I began to see things in the poems that nobody else had seen. You know, the Doppler effect, corpuscular and wave theories of light, the red shift, all of this was in the poems, and nobody had written about it. So I found my subject just by reading carefully. Recently, I've been co-editing the letters of Robert Frost with my colleague, Don Sheehy from Edinburgh, and a team living in Japan, Mark Richardson and Henry Atmore. And so the four of us have been putting together the complete letters of Robert Frost for Harvard University. And that project is going on as we speak. We just finished volume 3.
Wow.
Which will be out in April.
Without giving away too much of that project, what are some of these letters that are featured in here? Letters to colleagues, letters to family members, a little bit of all of that?
All of it. Every letter that we can find that we know Frost wrote is included in this series. So we envision at least a 6-volume series. They're long books, you know, they're about 700-800 pages apiece. It's an enormous amount of work because of the critical apparatus and annotations that we accompany the letters with. But it's also incredibly rewarding Frost was a very good epistolary stylist. And some of his letters are by turns witty. Some of them are heartbreaking. Some of them are very serious in nature. Some of them are full of advice to young writers and to his children. So you really begin to understand the complexities of this man and the intellectual genius that he really was simply by reading through his letters. And so it's a great project. And hopefully people will use the letters to reassess the biography and the life, and also to interpret the poems better.
Now, would you say that there are any sort of misunderstandings or things that people misinterpret about Robert Frost? Road Not Taken, I feel like, is one of those like graduation day poems where people talk about, you know, what it means, but there also could be some different meanings behind all these. So is there anything that you think people kind of misinterpret when it comes to the work of Robert Frost?
Well, when Lawrence Thompson published his biography in the 1970s after Frost had died, you know, it was a 3-volume biography that was completed by one of his graduate students. The portrait of Frost that he presented changed our perception of the man. And, you know, we were accustomed to sort of the Cracker Barrel Yankee sage with white hair, full of wisdom, full of good homespun humor as he read his poems on the dais at universities all over the country. But the portrait that Thompson presented was a far darker version of Frost than anyone had ever known anything about. So when Helen Vendler, the great poetry critic from Harvard, reviewed Thompson's biography, she labeled Frost a monster of egotism.
Wow.
And cited a few of the letters that had been published and had come to light at that time. And then, you know, so that was one version of the man. And then the other version was that Frost was little more than a sentimentalist. He was, you know, the purveyor of rhyming poetry in a world that preferred free verse, and something of the Norman Rockwell of American poetry. So these two different mythologies about Frost tended to skew our perceptions of him. And it wasn't until the early 1990s that a lot of writers began to correct these misinterpretations of the man in his poetry. Frost is an extremely complex poet filled with big ideas, and he's in no way a monster of egotism, as Vendler suggested. He is, you know, by contrast to that, or in contrast to that assessment, can be very tender, incredibly supportive. He was very loyal to his friends. He cared deeply for his family and his children, many of whom suffered from severe mental illness. And by all accounts, he was kind of the rock of the family that helped stay the family during moments of crisis.
Yeah, and I feel like as somebody who's analyzed his letters and correspondence over his lifetime, that's something that you could be an advocate for, is understanding who he is as a person, because there's no better way to learn about somebody than through their letters and through their writings.
Right. And my colleague Don Sheehy has been very good on helping to correct the biography. I mean, he was one of the first to discover Frost letters to his secretary, Kay Morrison, with whom he had a loving relationship after his wife, Eleanor, had died. And, you know, so there's been a continual and gradual reassessment of Frost's life and work through the last 20 years, 25 years. And, you know, when Don, for example, proposed writing about Robert Frost for his dissertation committee at the University of Virginia, the committee balked because they didn't see Robert Frost as being a serious enough figure as a subject for doctoral study, which is just hogwash. And unfortunately, Don convinced them otherwise, and thankfully so. So there are a lot of misperceptions, and part of our work is to correct those misperceptions of this great poet.
Yeah. So how have poets like Robert Frost and the lot, how have they influenced your own writing? So I know you're the author of a poetry collection called Counting Thunder,
Right.
and I'm sure you have a lot of other publications if you want to talk about those. But how have these writers and how have they influenced your own craft?
Well, I have a tendency, like Robert Frost and Theodore Retke and Elizabeth Bishop, to write in traditional forms. I don't limit myself exclusively to traditional forms. I also write in free verse. It really just depends on the subject matter. But one of my natural subjects is the pastoral tradition of American nature poetry that Frost and Wendell Berry and Mary Oliver represent. It's the tradition that I grew up with and that I loved. So I feel that I'm a kind of descendant in or inheritor of that particular lineage. So a good deal of my poetry is, in fact, nature poetry. I mean, if you'd like me to read some, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, if you could, that'd be great.
So this is about a whale. It's called Humpback. This time it's days before the mountain of the flesh begins to crack. And its echo song, its sounding of desire, grows too weak to warn the offshore pod. The dorsal blowhole heaves and groans, and its asthmatic rasp will not allow the locals who have come to let it die. Even the bravest won't shoot it like a horse. They who've seen themselves reflected in the still pond of its eye. And though they know that saving 60 tons of fat and fluke is hopeless now, they've gathered here for love, swabbing the back like the deck of a ship to wash and rinse away the smell of death. But it will not live, it will not die or drift back to the sea, where bladder wrack and flounder cling to rocks. And viscous currents sweep the lifeblood krill. No talk of cruelty interrupts their work. They've learned about disaster off the Cape, how some mistakes can never be repaired, the way this humpback, stranded, spouting blood, flapping its helpless fins like an amputee, learned too late its navigation failed and could not stop its weight behind the brain. And so they'll keep this vigil up for days. Armed with metal buckets and old mops, they'll try to quench the sun. And from where the tourists stand, the locals look like stagehands in a play. Enraptured by the one too good to fall, they gather at the coal house of its heart, the kitchen of its womb, and listen to this breaking down of life. This brutal transformation, cell by cell, of splendor into nothing and will not leave.
That's very good. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. How long ago was that something you recently wrote, or is that something you wrote in your career here at Edinburgh?
I think I wrote this poem maybe before I came to Edinburgh. I included it in my first collection. It was actually a poem that came from firsthand witness of an event such as this. Of course, one of the things that I love about our response to the natural world sometimes is that we do care for the things of the world, and we do care to try to mitigate suffering. I'm very convinced that when you're in the presence of people who treat animals beautifully, then you'll be in the presence of people who will treat other human beings beautifully as well. So that gesture of natural empathy and kinship is what I tried to capture in that poem.
Very interesting perspective. And I also think one thing to say about your writing in general, but also the field of natural poetry, is the things you're writing about are themselves very, I'm trying to say this the right way, like word worthy. I know there's a lot of use of whale imagery in writing, obviously, with Moby Dick, Herman Melville. There's so many things, like the whale in general is a very poetic creature, from their dives and their tails flapping up, to their blowhole, to the way that the biggest monster of the sea eats the smallest creature. Like, that it's just a very poetic creature. And I'm sure you found that along the way with your writing about this event.
Well, one of the beauties of the whale is that in some ways they seem more like us than other animals. You know, they have a very complex communication system. They're mammals, even though they live in the ocean. They rear their young on milk and so forth. And they're also in danger. You know, they were brought to the brink of extinction because of the whaling industry. And if it weren't for international trade laws and protections put in place, there's every reason to believe that whales wouldn't be with us today. So even though these creatures are massive, they're gentle giants, and we perceive them to be incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, and also relating more to humans, and this is somewhat metaphoric, but it could be very literal, is that the mothers, they starve themselves for months on end just so that their kids can grow and develop and have food. So from an empathy standpoint, from a caregiver standpoint, they are very relatable to humans. And I think that's kind of what stands out in that poem. And I also liked your description of the eyes too, the pool of eyes that you can almost get lost in. Look, if you ever made eye contact with a whale like that or see them in pictures, it's almost like you're staring at like a sad, but also like a helpless creature, but also as a strong stoic creature in general too.
You know, when I saw that phenomenon, I couldn't help but think that there was some sentience behind the eye, unlike other creatures of the, you know, fluvatorial world, like fish and sharks. There seemed to be something more behind the eye of the whale. And so you see yourself reflected in the, you know, surface of the eye itself. And it's that connection where, you know, you see yourself in the form of the whale. And so at least, you know, I'm glad that line resonated with you, because that was the intention of the line.
Yeah, it was. I love it because you kind of used an allusion to a different body of water too. How you used like a pond and the eye, and it kind of tied in the whole natural part of it together. It was a nice little like a play on natural words there. I thought it was a great descriptor. And I think that's kind of why personally I was drawn to natural poetry, is the way that you use descriptors, but also how you can make something very poetic by just using, as you said, nouns and verbs. So like a bird sitting on a lamppost can evoke so much of a strong memory. It's not like you need very descriptive adjectives and adverbs to make this poetry come to life.
Right. And sometimes, you know, in the more sentimental traditions of nature poetry, we tend to anthropomorphize the creatures of the natural world, whereby we inscribe them with human emotions as we try to interpret their behavior. And I think one of the turns of modernism was a turn away from that kind of gesture. So as Basho says in the Japanese tradition, if you want to know the pine, go to the pine. If you want to learn about the bamboo, go to the bamboo. Don't impose your own subjectivity onto these elements of the natural world. Simply observe them. Now, it's not to say that we don't interpret nature. We have to. We don't have any other choice. But the ways in which we interpret the natural world, and the more we understand the elements of the natural world, I think the less inclined we are to impose our own human subjectivities and habits upon those creatures.
Interesting. And also, speaking of like habits among the creatures and wilderness and nature, your poetry and your writing and the writers that you're interested in kind of reflect your own life outside of writing, per se. You're very interested in, you know, fly fishing, climbing mountains, and gardening. So talk a little bit about how once the writing and reading and research stops, that doesn't mean it's the end of the natural world for you. As a matter of fact, it kind of just heightens once you actually get into the experience itself. So talk about how your life kind of translates from the page to the field and almost vice versa.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I've been blessed because I was self-assessing enough to try to surround myself with things of beauty. I mean, fly fishing is an incredibly beautiful activity. Not only are you immersed in, you know, a world of the river or the stream and the woodland surrounding it, but there's also a rhythm to the activity. And, you know, there's a kind of necessity of being in that moment. Whereas, you know, in other realms of life, we're quite distracted and sometimes assaulted by things that aren't so beautiful. I mean, think of the world of the endless news cycle or the benumbing assaults of advertising. And, you know, I've tried to resist those things as much as I possibly can. And I think to good health and happiness on my part. So the fact that I write poetry, that I fly fish and like to grow a garden is, you know, to me, the recipe for how to live a life well. You know, when I'm hiking in the woods with my dog and I'm watching my dog porpoise through the obstacles of the forest and, you know, running with this incredible energy, I realize that I'm in the presence of a kinetic beauty that I'm stunned by, where this creature is just running along beside me off leash for the joy of it.
Yeah.
And you know that this creature, this dog, is happiest when he's in that particular mode. And I have to admit that I'm also happiness when I'm in that mode as well.
No perceived boundaries, limitless exploration, like, yeah, I mean, if we could ever capture that sort of energy and curiosity that animals have in the natural world, to some extent you do, being one with nature, being out in nature all the time. And I think the fly fishing itself, like you were saying, is just very poetic. Yes, there's a lot of mechanics involved, but seeing the fishing line flying in the air, seeing the creek, it's you take that excitement that, you know, a dog or a puppy sees and kind of, you know, adapt that to yourself, like trying to see it through their eyes and, you know, experiencing everything new and exciting. And I think it was what Norman McLean once said, you can step into a river twice, but everything changes, and it's probably not the stream, it's the man. Or that was a loose translation of it, but you can go to the same watering hole 10 times, but get a different experience just from having your senses open like that and having that beast-like imagery and that excitement. So, and I'm sure you find that in your experiences too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, imagine trying to be able to perceive the world through the olfactory senses of a dog. I mean, a great sense of smell, and just imagining how that puppy smells the world and what kind of information the nose brings to him, and how envious I am that I don't possess that capability.
And it's simple things like smelling a flower. They could either get a sense of enjoyment, or and then they smell a tree and maybe they're triggered into something dangerous or something unexpected. So it's their kind of like their emotions tied to their olfactory senses. It's something that, you know, we can't replicate, but we can often try and encapsulate through poetry and through writing too, being able to just describe what we're actually feeling almost through the lens of a dog, or, you know, the lens of somebody that's actually living the basic emotions of being in nature.
Right. I mean, I think the other great beauty, I agree with you totally, but I think one of the other great beauties of immersing yourself in the natural world is that you recognize, as science tells us, that we're not the paragons of animals, as Shakespeare said. You know, we're immersed in it. We're part of this grand matrix of nature as it unfolds before us. And I think when you begin to recognize something beyond the self and beyond the own ego, that is far more complex and intricate and beautiful than you are, and you recognize that you're simply part of it, it can be a very humbling experience. And I think if more of us had that kind of humbling experience, you know, we wouldn't be so inclined to assert our dominance over the natural world to try and shape it and control it and use it solely for our own purposes.
Letting it exist as it's supposed to, just like
right. We are. Right. I think part of, you know, the environmental ethos of my family was invested in that sense of recognizing a kind of humility within the natural world, recognizing your place within the natural world.
Interesting. Yeah. So one of the final things I want to discuss, it's a good segue into our last topic. The next generation, so we're talking about late millennials and Gen Z, there's a lot of movements towards almost resuscitating the natural protections we have with we have the Green New Deal, we have recycling efforts, we have a lot of people, you know, caring a lot about climate change and global warming. And I was just curious to see what your thoughts are on a bigger shift towards the natural world, and if there are any implications for future poets or any poets now that you think are capturing that essence. Because I know a lot of the poets that we mentioned are, you know, mid-century, 20th century poets. So what do you see happening with the shift towards the natural world and those implications for writing?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that the younger generation has come of age during a time of extreme upheaval. I mean, most millennials cut their teeth on 9/11, and then they experienced the Great Recession. And of course, the lessons of climate change have been part of their upbringing for an awful long time. And then most recently, of course, with the insurrection on the Capitol and the pandemic and so forth. So it's a generation that has witnessed the kinds of catastrophes that someone my age never had to witness. And so when I look at the change in poetry between the generation of, say, Wendell Berry and Mary Oliver, I see something very different happening. And, you know, part of the beauty of Wendell Berry and Mary Oliver was that their poems took us to places. You know, part of the idea behind agrarianism and pastoral poetry is developing a deep connection and love for specific places. And the idea is that if you can inculcate love of the natural world in your readers, then maybe they would be more inclined to protect it. Hmm. And I think that's been essential. But I would also suggest to you that now, with what we know about what's happening in the world, those gestures are not enough. So I think we need extended aesthetic forms and poetic forms with a harder hitting subject matter that is going to create the Jeremiads of our time that we need to sort of shake us out of our complacencies and, you know, disrupt with a kind of cognitive dissonance our sense of nature, because we recognize that it is incredibly vulnerable. Now, I can tell you, from my own experience, you know, I walk along or in a game lands by Cambridge Springs that we affectionately call Lando Lakes. And my friend Don Sheedy and I have birdwatched there for 15 years. And in the 15 years that we've been walking on that particular ground, you know, probably 150 times a year, you can see and witness subtle changes. The amount of bird life that we used to witness has plummeted. We see emergence of flowers and other species far earlier than we used to. We've seen an explosion in the tick population. Hmm. And all of these changes are the direct result of a changing climate. They're subtle changes, but if you're paying attention to them, you see them, and it creates a kind of uneasy backdrop, no matter what kind of beauty you're trying to create or convey in poetry. And I think this generation of poets is far more attuned to the necessity of recognizing that vulnerability and danger. I haven't seen a whole lot of poetry devoted to issues of climate change and global warming and natural catastrophe, but it's starting to come. But I have seen it in other media. I mean, there's a wonderful sculptor named Jason DeCares Taylor, for example, who creates these beautiful underwater sculptures, and he fashions them out of materials so that, you know, biological organisms and coral and so forth can grow on the sculptures that he uses or that he submerges in the oceans or lakes. And so he creates the structure and the territory with his art for life to regenerate and re-flourish.
Wow, that's interesting.
So the sculptures themselves convey the warning of our planet's vulnerability, but at the same time, they attempt to ameliorate the assaults of the world by using a medium that's designed to regenerate biotic life.
Wow.
And I think if we can think about translating some of those ideas to poetry, we'll be on the right track.
Perfect. That was a great way to end this conversation that I think could offer like an entire semester's worth of material there. Do you teach nature poetry courses here at Edinburgh, or do you kind of fit that into your American poetry studies and things like that?
Well, I do fit some of this into my American literature classes. I did teach an American nature writing class here a couple of times as special topics classes. So, and they tend to be well attended, and, you know, one of the things that I like to do is I like to take students out into the field, you know, and just start looking. So, it's kind of a combination of literary study and, you know, going out into the far field and back and trying to learn the lessons of, or interpret the lessons of what you've seen and then writing about it. I always hope to kind of instill some recognition of these values in some of my students.
Very interesting. Well, Dr. Bob Haas, thank you so much for joining us today on Tartan Talks. We're recording this episode in the middle of February, and as I look out my window, I can't think of too many poetic words to talk about the white snow that we see in the cold weather. So hopefully this episode gives us a little bit of motivation to get through winter and get towards the beautiful natural world. So thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your expertise.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right.